Most people, when they think of a late-night diner in America, picture dim lights, the slow hum of ceiling fans, and the unmistakable smell of bacon and coffee blending in the air. Every late-night diner might have a different neon sign, a unique theme, or a peculiar shade of decor, but deep down, everyone knows they all look the same. This isn't the fault of the architects, the designers, or the well-meaning owners trying to make their place stand out to lure in those inconspicuous customers. No, it's the fact that when the clock strikes late, usually past 10 p.m., no one really cares. The frames on the walls, the goofy signs, the undelivered promises of quality, they all fade into the background. At this hour, all the inconspicuous customers want is food that's mildly decent and the wait not too long. Because, after all, it's late, and the expectations are as dim as the lights. Now, people working late-night shifts in the food industry might argue with me on this point. They'll tell you that people actually care. Customers are picky. And oh, they will recite a catalogue of grievances. Stories of being cursed at, degraded, treated like servants, and so much more. Every server in America has their own memoir of unforgettable experiences with nasty customers, being victimized, belittled, and taken for granted. But I would argue with my fellow servers that the nasty attitude some customers carry, more often than not, has little to do with expectations about food or service. Instead, it's usually the culmination of a long day, or even years, of frustration and resentment. It finds its release when Sweet Patty, or Brookie, or Juan, whoever happens to be on the floor, comes around and asks, "Good evening, how can I help you?" But in all fairness, this quality isn't just exclusive to late-night customers. It's an overwhelming reality of the food industry itself. It's the awakening part of the American dream. I was working as a late-night server in a restaurant in Laughlin, Nevada, a small desert town people often compare to Las Vegas, calling it Little Vegas. But if you've ever worked or lived there, you'd know Laughlin is just more like a cheap version of Reno, at best. As for the name of the restaurant, well, that doesn't really matter. Because, as I said, all late-night diners look the same. Whether you're in a cheap version of Reno, or Las Vegas, or anywhere else in the country, they all feel the same. The same dim lighting, the same slow ceiling fans, the same tired, inconspicuous customers, and most importantly, the same undercurrent of frustration brewing all day long. It was 11 p.m., the slowest time of the day, in the slowest season of the year. Just me on the floor, and a solitary cook lost in his habitual self-talk, complaining about the cooks from the shift before, all the sins they committed, all their wrongdoings, and the classic Pinchy's Lacey's people coming from the darkest corner of his soul. This is another great topic about the food industry, the battles between shifts, the hate for each other, the pettiness of their discrepancies. The whole thing is so massive, so nuclear and justifiable at the same time. It could take years to write about, let alone fit into this short story. But anyhow, it was 11 p.m. and I only had one customer left, an old man who looked like he'd stumbled into the wrong place or the wrong decade. Grey hair, an unkempt beard, and a gleaming golden watch on his left wrist. None of that was remarkable, except for the fact that he was one of those customers. The universal term we servers use to describe all difficult customers. And oh, lordy, he was mean and difficult. He didn't start off that way, though. At first, it was just mild sarcasm, harmless enough, even witty. But as the night wore on, the sarcasm shifted from clever to just plain effrontery and derogatory language. It was no surprise to me. I've been in this situation countless times, and after all my years of experience as a server, I'd developed a system for handling this kind of situation. A simple technique. Just smile. But smile in a way that leaves them guessing whether I'm smiling with disregard or secretly mocking them inside, maybe even wondering if I understand English at all. It always works. And it worked well that night. My technique is infallible, but it took longer than usual with him. A few trips back and forth bringing more coffee, a remaking of his toast to be golden brown, not just toasted, because, as he said, there's a difference. But once we both quietly established that neither of us would break, he quit with the verbal jabs and just settled into his obvious discomfort. I'd managed to handle the situation, but I didn't feel like I 1. I just felt relief that I'd been able to ignore his nasty attitude and hoped he'd pay and leave. I'd had enough. But then, when I came back to his table to bring his check, I couldn't help but notice one of his shoes was untied. I tried to be friendly at last and pointed it out to him. He looked at me a little surprised and attempted to tie the shoe, but he struggled to bend down. Pain and some shame was written all over his face, and without hesitation, not thinking twice, I knelt down and helped him tie his shoe. He asked me, "Please don't do that," but I just said, "It's all good, brother. It's just a shoe that needs to be tied up." He had a clever smirk about to bloom, and I could tell he was about to say something witty again. But then he hesitated. He looked at me for a moment, placed his finger to his lips, as if signaling to quiet his own thoughts, to keep his cool, and then his voice crumbled, and he simply said, "Thank you. Thank you very much." He shed one single tear that travelled slowly down his face, disappearing on its own. In that moment, after seeing him that vulnerable yet so real and strong, I forgot I was just another minimum wage employee in another late night restaurant in America. I became as human as he had become. Human in a way we sometimes forget to be, in the petulance of our daily affairs. I took his wrinkled hand, held it, and stayed there in silence with him. After that moment we shared, he apologized. He admitted he'd been deliberately harsh that night. He told me he'd been angry at life, at everything, that his wife, the love of my life, my best friend and all, had passed away just a few months ago. "Cancer," he said. "Fuck that. And all of this. I hate it here." And he tapped his chest twice. I accepted his apology and simply said, "Life just sucks sometimes, doesn't it?" He smiled with warmth, a real smile this time, and nodded. "Oh yes, it does, Jose. Yes, it does." Now, my name tag clearly stated that my name was not Jose, but I knew it wasn't sarcasm this time. No animosity in sight, just a joke coming from the new old friend I had just made. He stood up, looked at me for a moment, and asked if he could please shake my hand. "By all means, brother," I said. "By all means." And I shook his hand. "I'm glad I stopped by," he said while paying for his check. "I wasn't planning on it. I was looking for another restaurant. But all these places look the same, don't they?" "Just at late night, sir," I said, smiling. "Just at late night."